American businesses need more skilled workers. How do we find talent and develop it? And how do we create opportunities for everyone in our society to find a good job and build a rewarding career? You're listening to Work in Progress. I'm Ramona Schindelheim, Editor-in-Chief of Working Nation, a nonprofit media company telling stories about the future of work, the future of education, and closing the job skills gap. Work in Progress explores the rapidly changing workplace through conversations with innovators, educators, and decision makers, people with solutions to today's workforce challenges. We often say that talent is everywhere, but there are barriers to opportunity. Gender, race, and class can prevent a hiring manager from considering some of the best candidates. And these same managers can also be swayed by a perfect resume that doesn't tell them everything. My guest today says data-driven tools can better identify people who will thrive and will stay at a company.
If we can create more and more structures to break down those barriers and make it possible for the most exceptional among us to move into those jobs, then, you know, we'll unlock a massive amount of productivity, but also have a massive impact on our country's ability to deliver our competitive advantage.
Mike Rosenbaum founded Catalyte, a company that uses data to help build a diverse and sustainable workforce in tech, and the spinoff company Arena for the healthcare field. He explains how data-driven tools can be more productive and effective than traditional hiring, both for the employer and the employee. Thank you, Mike, for joining us.
Thanks for having
Work
me.
In Progress. Yeah. We want to start a little bit talking about how you transitioned from the world of academia into being an entrepreneur. So tell me a little bit about the origin of Catalyte.
Sure. I was a fellow at Harvard teaching and doing research on economics and law. And while I was doing it, I did a little bit of work for the Clinton White House, originally around technology policy and then around labor issues. The Clinton White House was building a cluster of policies based on the idea that lower-income communities could be untapped retail and distribution markets. And some of them were known as the Empowerment Zone Program.
Oh, yeah.
And I disagreed with the policies. I said, it may be true that a lower-income community is an untapped retail or distribution market, but more significantly, it's an untapped talent market. And it's an untapped talent market because the market for talent is based on resumes. Resumes correlate with socioeconomic background and race and gender, but they're not necessarily great predictors of success in a job. And I had a college roommate who had worked at D.E. Shaw, which is a high-speed trading hedge fund. And I said, D.E. Shaw is applying large amounts of data to the financial markets to get them to work better. What if we were due to do the same thing in the labor market? And if we were to apply large amounts of data to the labor market, we could get folks who were better at a job into the job, and individuals would be better off, organizations would be better off, and everyone would be happy. And the response was, the guy who came up with the other idea is more famous than you are. We're going with him. I lost the argument. went back to my ivory tower, and my academic advisor, who was going to help me get the assistant professor job, said, I think you're more interested in doing this than in writing about it. Maybe you should go do it. And so I moved to Baltimore because it was a post-industrial city. There was a GM plant there that was on the verge of shutting down, and there was a Bethlehem Steel plant on the verge of shutting down. And I started Catalyte, which is the first business I started, to apply data to find folks who, once they received training, would be in the top 2% of all software engineers. And that was really how I started and built a piece of technology with a bunch of people that would do that.
What are the data points? I mean, what was it that you were diving into to see who would be better, who would be in that top 2%?
So when we first started, we tried a whole bunch of stuff. We tried just sort of typical tests. So use a test that would measure math skills. And we also used, in the early days, we experimented with things like hand-eye coordination. So we'd have folks assemble Tinker toy sets and collect data related to their assembling the Tinker toy sets. It's very difficult to scale.
I love that, though. who would have thought of that? You.
Yeah. And we just collect data to see if we could correlate with success as a software engineer, and we couldn't, actually. We did some experiments in the early days with rapid eye movements. There was some research that had come out of Hopkins that rapid eye movements would correlate with the ability to defer gratification, and we had a hypothesis that the ability to defer gratification would correlate with success as a software engineer. And so we tried to measure rapid eye movements and correlate those, but that totally failed because we couldn't get high resolution enough cameras to do it at a cost-effective enough level. But so we experimented with a whole bunch of things, and what happened over time was we found there were different buckets of data that told us things. So one of the buckets of data that sometimes would tell us things were local labor markets. So the local labor market and data about the local labor market could tell us something about whether or not someone was going to achieve an outcome in that market. Another piece of information that sometimes would tell us stuff would be stuff related to a typical job application, actually. So the original thesis was that resumes were irrelevant. It turned out that sometimes that was true, but often it wasn't true. It was just that resumes didn't necessarily tell you what you thought they told you. So, for example, we found there was no statistically significant correlation between a college degree and success as a software engineer. But then over time, we would find things like correlations in open text that people would write, or in things like we would find no correlation sometimes with gaps in employment. Or things like people being leaders in community organizations, which would tell us some things in certain places and other things in other places. And so there was that kind of information. And then we did ultimately find that asking questions was relevant in some form of online mechanism, but that often what was more relevant when you ask a question was measuring someone's keystrokes as opposed to the actual answer someone gave. So those were the kinds of data points.
That is like amazing, though, that you could figure this out with those non-traditional. If I was interviewing somebody for a job, how fast can you type, you know, to be a software engineer?
Yeah. So, and in fact, when we first started, we thought that typing speed was really important. You know, it turned out not to be as important as we thought it was. But So for Catalyte, which was the first business I started that's really focused on identifying software engineers, we use probably 600 or 700 data points in a typical algorithm. In for Arena, which is the other business that I have spun out of that, that's focused on the healthcare industry, that number is closer to 10,000.
Amazing. I want to ask a couple more questions about Catalyte, and then we'll talk a little bit more about Arena. What is this? 20 years? How long has Catalyte been around?
About 19 years.
19.
When I first started working on the technology.
So where are we today in, filling the jobs out there? There are so many jobs that go unfilled. Where are we at, like, in a bigger picture, not necessarily from your company, but the future of work? Where are we at in closing the skills gap?
I mean, my closest exposure to this is the data sets that Catalyte and Arena have. But when you look at those data sets and you think about, you know, just in tech, I mean, how many open software engineering jobs are there? How many open software engineering jobs will there be, particularly when we think about technology as being so at the core, particularly of this country's competitive advantage internationally? You know, the number is a seven-figure number, you know, in terms of the number of jobs that aren't getting filled and aren't going to be filled. And yet, when we think about the number of people in the United States who are underemployed, you know, the number is massive, you know, and I'm sure you've done a bunch of many interviews on that topic. You know, when we look at large pools of people for Catalyte, when we say who's going to be in the top echelon of software engineers, and we look at folks who have at least a GED, we find that we're typically identifying somewhere between 5 and 10% of the folks who are interested, occasionally a little bit more depending on the market. If you start from the assumption that there are 50 or 75 million people in the U.S., who are underemployed, and if it's 5%, then, you know, what that means is that there are several million people who can fill those jobs.
And that makes sense mathematically.
You know, and when you think about, so for Catalyte, the average income of someone before we identify someone as someone who will be in the top echelon of all software engineers, average income is $25,000 a year. Average income 5 years later is $98,000 a year. You know, something like north of 90% are making six figures within 6 years. And so, you know, you're talking about a pretty high percentage of folks who are moving into, you know, into sort of the middle class and beyond. And, you know, and if, I mean, obviously, Catalyte's what I know best, Arena's what I know best,
right.
But, you know, but mechanisms like that to break down the barriers that, you know, that are, you know, often sort of implicit race issues, implicit gender issues, you know, but probably most of all, class issues.
Mm-hmm.
If we can create more and more structures to break down those barriers and make it possible for the most exceptional among us to move into those jobs, then you know, will unlock a massive amount of productivity, you know, but also have a massive impact on, you know, on our country's ability to deliver, you know, our competitive advantage.
You've probably heard the saying, and we talk about it a lot, talent is everywhere, but opportunity, there's barriers. Mm-hmm. So this sounds like you're trying to figure out how to get the employer to understand there's talent here. Maybe their resume doesn't look like they're the ideal candidate, but their skills reflect they are.
So when Catalyte first started, our original idea was we were going to license technology to large employers to do this. And what we found is that folks didn't buy it. It was just too much of a leap. And so we ended up starting what was effectively a tech-enabled services business to disintermediate the technology from the customer, the folks who needed software engineering talent. Catalyte grew that way for a long time. We've now moved back into licensing. It's a very different era today mm-hmm. than it was when I first started doing this work. But Catalyte is the employer in certain circumstances, and a client is the employer in other circumstances. We find that the most important way of getting an employer for a customer for Catalyte to work with Catalyte is the outcome data. And, you know, the outcome data is essentially that using these kinds of technologies, or Catalyte specifically, to assemble a software engineering team generates something like 3x the productivity metrics at like half the defect rate. And, you know, there are a whole range of large enterprises that have done large data dumps related to that. You know, Nike was the first, released a bunch of data on using Catalyte to assemble its workforce related to a product it was developing called the Fuel Band. Choice Hotels has done it, Starwood has done it, Cambia Health has done it, and it's that data that essentially proves to a large enterprise that assembling its workforce using these methods and using these technologies is more productive and more effective than traditional hiring. That is really what gets folks to adopt it.
In the last couple of years, you've moved on, not moved on, you're still with Catalyte, but you've moved into another company as well, created another company, Arena. Can you tell me a little bit, what was the catalyst for that?
Sure. I met someone socially who was an executive at a hospital in the D.C. suburbs. She asked me what I did, and I told her, and she said, you know, we have this really big problem, which is that we turn over like 25% of our staff every year. And we have certain jobs like certified nursing assistant, where over a third of the people we hire may not be employed a year later. Can you help us? And I said, I don't actually know that much about healthcare. And we talked with her and with a couple of her colleagues, and they said, you know, what if we were an early customer? Do you think you could figure it out? We said, sure. So we made a copy of the technology that was in Catalyte, and we put it in a subsidiary. And we used it to predict the likelihood that a given individual would stay in a particular job under a particular manager in a particular location in a particular role. We deployed it to that one hospital and to a handful of hospitals and a couple long-term care facilities in 2010. And it worked too well. Like, so we reduced their turnover by these massive numbers, and I just didn't buy it. And I said, we don't even know what an RN does for a living. We may have reduced turnover by 58%. We don't even really know what reducing turnover even means. So we spent several years working in, you know, with our teams, who were primarily data scientists and software engineers, sitting in hospitals and long-term care facilities, figuring out what data we could get, what data we couldn't get, how is a hospital put together, what does an RN do for a living, what does a CNA do for a living, and refined the technology, and it got better. And in 2013, I said, okay, we can invest more in this. We started to build up the team. Catalyte and Arena were sort of growing both very well in different directions. We spun Arena out the end of 2014, took about a year and a half to split up the businesses. But the core idea was that Arena could predict the likelihood that someone was going to achieve an outcome, and that if an organization could use that information, then it could use that to supplement individuals, but in particular to attack implicit biases, some of which are malicious, you know, implicit bias based on race and gender, obviously mm-hmm. malicious, some of which are not as malicious, like a belief in a particular credential or a particular number of years of experience. And that if you could do that, that you could help an organization operate much more effectively, and you could help route folks into the jobs where they'd be most likely to succeed. The core problem we were originally trying to solve was that someone would be, that individuals are bad at hiring. What we found was there was a second problem that was also important to solve, which is that I, as an individual job applicant, don't always know where I'll thrive. And so what Arena does is it figures out those questions and then routes folks into the places where they'll achieve the best outcomes.
So, yeah, you were telling me some of the, maybe kind of an example was someone who knew someone who was an RN, so they thought, that's what the job should be at a specific place. Do you work with the applicant? How does that work?
So today, the primary work that ARENA does is with a large employer. So today, ARENA is deployed into organizations in healthcare, and that includes senior living and skilled nursing, whose applicants represent about 13% of the U.S. healthcare workforce, 2.6 million unique job applicants a year, also a little bit in restaurants. And so what happens is we'll make a prediction related to a given individual with the idea initially of sort of moving the needle on operating metric. And we will have a limited interaction with an applicant, but today, not a lot. Today, what will happen is we'll deliver information to the employer saying, this person applied to this job. It turns out, you know, they'd be unlikely a year later to report that they're an engaged employee in this job. But there's this other job they didn't apply to where they would be likely to say they're engaged a year later, or they'd be likely to stay, or they'd be unlikely to be involved in some sort of incident. And so that's how we do it today. We're actually rolling out an extension to the product so that will be different at the end of this year. But today, that's how the product works.
The way you got into your first company was somebody gave you advice and said, this doesn't sound like you really want to be in academia. And then someone came to you for your next company and said, can you do this? And you go, I don't know anything about that. But despite all that, I get a sense that there is something, you know, you went into Baltimore, which, you know, had, you know, economic troubles. You're talking to people in healthcare who sometimes they're not the best paid. It feels like there's something in you that you really, really want to help people, though.
So before I got into this work, when I was in school, what I thought I was going to do, I did a bunch of work in Russia. And what I taught and what I did research on was macroeconomic transition. So, you know, the transition for the former Soviet Union, Eastern Europe, China to a lesser extent, from one form of an economy to another form of an economy. And it generated a lot of political instability. And the question is, sort of, what do you do about it? And, you know, I ended up pivoting my life around doing this work more domestically because I realized that closer to home, there are a whole set of questions about how our economy is structured that limit socioeconomic mobility, which in turn generates political instability. And, you know, what I found I was most passionate about in the world was figuring out how to deal with questions of socioeconomic mobility, because if you can move the needle on that set of questions, you can help individuals find dignity. Each of us can find dignity. Each of us can find hope. And in doing so, we can be a more peaceful society. And that was really what I found to be most inspiring about this kind of work. And so that's why I've dedicated my professional life to it.
I find that very inspiring, too. So thank you very much, Mike, for joining me.
Thank you so much for having me.
Work in Progress is produced by Working Nation, your source on the future of work. I'm Ramona Schindelheim, and my guest today was Mike Rosenbaum, founder of Catalyte and ARENA, companies that develop data-driven tools to find the right employees. To hear more about the future of work and workers, subscribe to Work in Progress wherever you get your podcasts. Thanks to our producer, Larry Buell, and executive producers, Joan Lynch and Melissa Panzer. Our theme music was composed by Lee Rossevere. See you next time.